Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Movie Crush, Friday interview edition. Casey's in his house.
Hello.
How's it going?
It's going good, man. The weather's cooled down.
Yes.
So it feels like the appropriate time to talk about this movie.
Yeah. Wasn't that weather thing weird? It was like two Saturdays ago.
Yeah.
Or no, it was Halloween.
Yeah.
When the temperature dropped like 30 degrees in an hour
and a
half.
It's a 30-degree swing. It was crazy.
It was so fast. It was crazy. It was really, really... it provided for a spooky Halloween.
It did.
It's kind of perfect.
Kind of unique, strange atmosphere.
And you do mention the weather in this movie, and we're talking about the Ice Storm, the, to me, classic film from Ang Lee, 1997.
Absolutely.
Based on Rick Moody's novel, screenplay by James Shamus. And the weather in this movie is so important.
It's like another character. It's kind of a cliche, but
it really is
true.
Yeah.
And it's kind of this is jumping ahead, but it's like the unifying thing because everybody is so alienated and disconnected and kind of talking past each other and trying their best to kind of stay in their bubbles of isolation and not kind of like, you know, breach the surface of like polite conversation.
Yeah, they're icy relationships.
Yeah, and the ice storm kind of is the thing that finally forces everyone to kind of deal with each other as like real human beings.
Yeah.
And you could find kind of similar – I was thinking in terms of like, you know, Shortcuts, there's like the earthquake at the end.
Yeah.
Magnolia, there's the frogs, of course.
Right.
You know, there are these idea like the idea of like an ensemble cast that's kind of all brought together by this unifying kind of natural event.
Yeah, totally. I saw this in the theater in 1997 when I was living in New Jersey. I went to the Angelica Film Center in New York.
Cool.
One of my favorite places, which is where I saw The Lighthouse recently. And it really, like, really moved me at the time.
Oh, yeah.
And has become one of my favorite films. And I've said this before, and I'll say it again. It somehow, Ang Lee, and it shows what a great director he is, you know, of Asian descent, somehow captures America in the 1970s better than any American director that I've ever seen, maybe.
Yeah, well, maybe – I mean, that might be because it's not – first-hand knowledge so much to him.
Maybe. It's not a nostalgia trip.
You have to find it in research and reference and really like studying hard. And of course, I mean, he has the benefit of amazing production design and so on. But I think sometimes the best films about America are made by non-Americans. You think of like Paris, Texas by Wim Wenders or something.
Oh, yeah.
It's the idea of like shooting America kind of as a foreign country.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you're from a place – obviously, you have a high degree of like intense familiarity with it.
Right.
That can almost blind you in a way.
But maybe not the fascination that someone like Ang Lee might have.
Exactly. So, you know, it's everything's kind of new again when you're coming with a different perspective. So,
yeah. Boy, this movie just nailed it. I mean, I grew up when was this set? 73.
73. Yeah. And they make a lot about, you know, there's a lot of emphasis put on it being 73 in particular.
Right.
The
Nixon.
Yeah, Nixon, and just kind of the idea that it's only a few years after the 60s, and yet it feels like we've entered this new age, this kind of malaise, this sense of like the revolution didn't come.
Right.
You know, and the kind of like the dream is sort of dead, and now it's just this like lost time where people feel kind of, you know, they're just not sure what they're doing. Everybody's a little bit lost.
Yeah, I mean, it's that that post 60s malaise, like you said, when everyone, I think in the late 60s, there was so much hope.
Yeah.
For change, and then I think, historians point to the Democratic National Convention,
right, 68,
as sort of the turning point when things started to, to go bad.
Yeah. Of course, you have like 69, you have Sharon Tate murder, you know, all that Manson.
And I think at the time, the 70s were sort of – we look back at them now as like, you know, with great glee. But I think at the times, everyone was like, the 70s kind of sucks.
Yeah. And I think too, like the first few years of any given decade is always like a weird blend where there's so much holdover from the decade prior.
Right.
And it's still – you're still kind of feeling your way into what this thing's going to be. And it's really not until I think later in the decade that you kind of solidify like what even is this decade, you know?
Yeah. I'm fascinated with that stuff, man, because of time, the arbitrary nature of a person and man saying, well, this is our calendar – and this is the end of something, and this is the beginning of something, when it's like, no, that was just yesterday.
It's very arbitrary.
Today is no different.
Yeah.
But what it is forget the calendar numbers, forget months and years and decades. It's the passage of time and the sun rising and setting over a long enough period, which we call years, that does mean something.
And it's kind of like – I mean it's almost a chicken and egg thing. Do we have decades because we have the system that we think in terms of tens and like
– or we just categorized
it. Yeah, yeah. We categorized it, but then also like do we feel an obligation almost to switch up what we're doing when it becomes like another decade?
Well, I think that's definitely true.
Yeah.
And especially when you see things like Boogie Nights when 79 goes into 80.
Oh, yeah.
It feels like a switch is flipped.
Yes.
It's like it's a brand new thing for everyone.
Well, they introduce it in a hell of a way.
You can start over, you know? Really interesting.
Yeah. And I think also the something on the commentary track that Ang Lee talks about a lot, and James Shamus, who's also on the commentary, they were conscious that, you know, in a year like 1973, there's still going to be people dressed like it's still the 60s and so on.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't do that so much in this film. They really went for everything to feel like up to the minute kind of.
Yeah.
And their sort of rationale for that was that they're not creating necessarily something that feels like a camera dropped into 1973 and started filming.
Mm-hmm.
It's more about the memory of that period and what we associate with it. And so it's almost more 1973 than 1973. You know, it's a more perfect version of 1973.
Yeah, although it feels like someone dropped a camera into 1973.
Yeah.
Like,
well, because your memory of it probably, you know.
Probably so.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because so, you know, I was 2 years old in 73, so obviously you don't have memories of that. But I have very distinct memories of 75, 76, 77, and what life was like then. And this really was very evocative for me.
Yeah.
Like it hit a lot of not nostalgia buttons because there's not anything in this movie that's happy.
The closest they get is like that shot of Wendy's foot when she's got the multicolored like toes on the sock.
Yeah. There are little hints like
that. And just
that.
just like little kind of funny things like that. But they're few and far between. By and large, this is not a nostalgia movie. It's not a sort of like look at how funny everybody was dressed back then sort of thing.
No, and no one feels – and this is a testament to the set design and the costumes and wardrobe, but no one ever feels like they're in a costume.
Yeah, exactly.
It just feels very real.
Yeah.
Even the way over the top 70s-ness of the Sigourney Weaver and Jamie Sheridan's house.
Yes.
Which, by the way, like I want to live
I do too.
In that house.
Absolutely.
Even the colonial Kevin Kline's, like those picture windows by that river in the backyard, like this forested suburb was just like – it was – because this is sort of how I grew up. I grew up in the woods on a house with a street with 8 houses. It wasn't like some big suburban neighborhood.
Right, right.
And we had a creek in the woods behind our house and we lived on like 2 acres.
Yeah.
So this – in the wintertime in my home, it reminded me very much of what was going on here.
Yeah. I know for me like watching watching the film, the first time I saw it, I didn't get to see it in theaters, but I saw it on DVD like probably the next year, 98 or so.
How old were you?
I would have been 15.
Interesting.
So, I you know.
Interesting age to see this.
Watching it at that age, obviously my most intense identification was with Tobey Maguire, Paul Hood.
Mm-hmm.
And something about watching it. I think I watched it, you know, during the winter, during the cold months.
Yeah.
And
it's not a summer film.
No, no. And I was, you know, I was upstairs, my parents' house in my room.
Mm-hmm.
And I just had this sense of, you know, it's when you're, especially when you're a teenager, at least a lot of teenagers get this way. They kind of isolate from their families a little bit. They want to define themselves separately. And so you're kind of... It's weird because you're sort of with your family because you're still living under their roof.
Uh-huh.
You're still seeing them for meals and, you know, interactions and so on.
Right.
But you're also kind of tucking yourself away, like creating a separate thing. And I have this feeling of, watching that film, knowing that, you know, my parents are like downstairs, but I'm kind of up here and I'm having this experience and so on.
It's like we'll meet up a couple of times a day.
Yeah, yeah.
And break bread.
And just like, you know, it's like Kevin Kline says in the movie to Paul, he's like, you know, the whole point of you coming home is so that your mother and I can wait on you hand and foot and you can grunt at us and we can give you more food. And it's like we enjoy that kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, at the time, that idea seems very strange and kind of like he must not mean it or something. But of course he does, you know. He misses that sense of just like being a parent and caring for somebody. Now watching it, gosh, how many years later? Like 22 years later?
Yeah, crazy.
It's a very different experience for me because like in the novel,
Did you read it?
Yeah, well, sort of.
Okay.
I took a class in college where every film that we were assigned was an adaptation of a book.
Okay.
And so we were assigned the book and the film.
Mm. So did you cheat on this one?
I didn't really cheat. I just kind of I read enough of the book, I guess. Okay. You know, I read enough of the book to get
I'd like to
get
read
the gist.
It.
It's really funny. I took it out again to look over for this episode, and I found like my bookmark from 2004.
Where was it? What page?
It was page like 187 or something.
Oh, that's respectable.
So I made it most of the way through, but I bailed at some point. And so then for this, I just went back and reread like the very first chapter. Where was I going with all that? Oh, so watching it now. Mm-hmm. So in the book, it mentions that Benjamin Hood, the Kevin Kline character, is 39. I'm 36 now. And so
39.
I know.
Jesus.
He plays a little bit, maybe slightly older in the film, I think.
I feel like they all felt like they were 44.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So definitely like mid-40s, I think. So in the book, he's just slightly younger.
Yeah.
But at the same time in the book, he's described as kind of like having lost his hair already.
Oh, interesting.
Just feeling extremely like over the hill kind of and sort of like past it.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the film, Kevin Kline is still very like, you know, handsome and you know.
Virile,
exactly. So there's a slight difference there. But in terms of like his own kind of midlife crisis and everything, I think that's more or less the same in both.
Yeah, man. It's boy, this is a movie about I've seen this movie a bunch of times, but it had been a minute. It's such a movie about people seeking connections and not ever getting them.
Missing them, yeah.
I mean, sometimes, but rarely. And I just kept counting so many instances where it's a husband trying to connect with a wife or a parent trying to connect with a child.
Yeah.
Or children trying to make connections with each other.
Yeah.
They kind of become more connected than anyone, I guess.
Yes. I think Wendy and Sandy, you know, end up having like the best genuine connection.
Yeah.
That, you know, they're like in bed together. As far as we can tell, they're not doing anything sexual. They're just kind of like with each other.
I read one
cuddling,
review
you know?
Said something about like, you know, one of them loses their virginity.
No.
I'm like, no.
No.
I don't even – I think
the kid, you know, the Sammy, he passes out drunk like almost immediately.
Yeah.
And they just kind of like – they're just keeping each other warm basically.
And their kids, they're playing adult.
Yeah, exactly.
All the adults are playing kid and all the kids are playing adult.
Absolutely.
But they're doing – you know, they're drinking the vodka and then they take off their clothes and get in bed together.
Yeah.
Because that's what they see all around them.
That's what their parents do. Yeah. That's what they've kind of been taught. That's the model that they've kind of learned. So
it's all very innocent though. Like that age, that adolescent age where you don't know what the fuck is going on in your body.
Yeah.
You don't know what these feelings are. You don't know how to do any of this stuff physically. It's just so awkward in this movie. And it doesn't like – I don't know. I feel like a lot of movies, like coming of age, play it too broad with the lack of awareness about sex and how to do things.
It can be way over the top sometimes.
And this is just so real, man.
It's perfect. Yeah.
It's just like I remember having these feelings and fumbling around and being like, you know, and I had parents who like they didn't tell me about any stuff.
Right, right. Never so, had like the talk.
Fuck no, I didn't know what was going on. You're picking all this stuff up secondhand off the playground. Some of it blatantly wrong.
That's how. Yeah, I mean, that's how you learn. You learn it from like the older kids, you know, or maybe like someone that's your age who heard it from their older sibling. Or
yeah, like a 14-year-old is learning about sex from a 16-year-old, which is so funny.
Find a Playboy in the woods or whatever.
Oh
you know?
Yeah, that old move.
Yeah.
It's like, I wonder what's in that treehouse.
But it's funny. Sigourney Weaver has that great speech to Wendy where she's like, you know, in adolescence, our bodies betray us and your body is your temple and you only get one in this life. It's your first and last possession. And
I know. It's interesting the takes that the parents have on this stuff because they're all different.
She has that funny thing where she says, you know, and like she calls it like developing countries or something.
Uh-huh.
She's like, you know, they just when the kids reach a certain age, they send them off into the woods without any weapons or anything. And they don't come back until they've learned a thing or two.
Yeah.
And you don't really, you know, you kind of know what she's getting at. But to the kid, it's just like, what are you talking about?
Well, and that was Christina Ricci is so good in this. All the acting is just off the charts in this movie.
I mean, the cast is insane. Like the number of people.
Yeah.
Katie Holmes, I don't think even gets like billing up front.
It was her first film.
Yeah, yeah.
It was her film debut.
Yeah. So when she pops up, you know, first time around anyway, it's like, oh, my gosh, it's, you know.
Tobey Maguire, of course, Joan Allen. We'll just tick through the cast. Yeah. Kevin Kline are the married couple, Christina Ricci and Tobey Maguire. Their kids, Sigourney Weaver, who is, I think, kind of steals the movie in a lot of ways.
Absolutely.
If you can steal this movie.
Yeah.
Jamie Sheridan is great. And then Elijah Wood and Adam Hun or Han Bird as Sandy, who is so good in this movie.
Yes.
And forget, like, David Krumholtz.
Yes.
Krumholtz is in it. He's one of my favorite actors of all time.
Oh, my God. Just like the ultimate asshole kind
of. Oh, my
God. But I feel like we all knew that guy.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Like your back is turned and he's moving in on your girl.
Yes, yes.
Like your best friend.
Right, right.
Totally.
Yeah.
So that was a good overview. We'll kind of go in order, but we can go all over the place.
Sure, sure.
But the movie opens with that great through line of the Fantastic Four stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So effective.
In a kind of a funny, I don't know, irony of history or something that you've got Tobey Maguire who goes on to play Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Ang Lee who goes on to direct Hulk. You've got, you know,
Katie
Holmes. This is not Marvel, but Katie Holmes who's in
Wonder
Batman Begins.
Boys.
And Wonder Boys too,
What was the first one you said? Was in what?
Batman Begins.
Oh,
just
right.
A, you know, comic book adaptation.
Uh-huh. And I think Pleasantville was Joan Allen and Tobey Maguire. There's a lot of weird crossover.
Yeah, a lot of crisscrossing in that period in like, you know, semi-independent film.
Yeah.
Although it's backed by a larger studio, it's, you know, very much like in that mold.
Yeah, and didn't do well.
Yes.
It was kind of a commercial flop.
Well, they say on the commentary, one of the first things James Sheamus says to Ang Lee is like, so Ang, here it is, like your worst tested movie ever. Like, you know,
just
feedback that was ever given.
Because he's made some pretty bad movies over the last like 10 or 15 years.
I know.
And some good ones. He's confounding.
He's hard to pin down. He swings between so many different genres and
Something like Life of Pi was really good.
Yeah,
but this new movie just is
Gemini
getting
Man.
Atrocious.
Yeah,
I've
reviews. I've seen some positive, you know, words written about it
by
like cinephile type people.
Huh.
But there's a certain thing that happens with some cinephiles where it's almost like a contrarianism or sort of like fetishizing the film that's rejected by a mass audience and rediscovering like something good about it.
Like everyone hates this, so let me take a closer
look. Yeah, let's take a closer
that's
look
valid.
At this. So it is valid. And of course, Ang Lee is like a director that's worth making that kind of investment in and sort of taking a closer look and saying like, is this really as bad as people are saying, et cetera.
Right.
But
I agree.
Yeah, he is somebody that, I mean, I feel like he's never made another film remotely like in this mold, you know? Like a domestic drama or even just, really, really anything that comes close to the feeling that this film gives. And maybe it's better that he doesn't because how are you going to improve? How are you going to, you know?
Yeah. And this movie was a real throwback to, I mean, set in 73, but a throwback to a time when they were making these adult dramas that they certainly don't feel like they make anymore. Yeah. And I don't even think they were making them that much in 1997.
Right. Yeah. I mean, already it was starting to it had been turning since whatever you want to say, like Star Wars and all the rest of it, late 70s. But certainly like by the 90s, there was that kind of moment, that resurgence of the independent film and Sundance and all that kind of stuff was happening. But the kind of like big budget adult drama that we used to see all the time in the 70s.
Yeah, this was an $18 million budgeted film.
Crazy. This would be made for like $500,000 today.
You know? It would. I imagine they paid the cast pretty well.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I can't imagine what else they were spending on.
I mean,
it was a bunch of interiors and just a few locations.
Yeah. They did shoot it in like the real New Canaan, which is interesting.
I thought that was cool.
May be that could have added to the budget if it wasn't necessarily like a film friendly or film ready type city.
Yeah, not that much though.
But yeah, not that much. Well, I mean, I guess you're paying to have the cast and crew stay there because you're not shooting in like L.A. or New York. Or
yeah, I mean, location's always a bit more, but on commercials.
It's not $18 million worth though.
No, yeah, certainly not. But what's your take on the Fantastic Four stuff? I love this kind of narration. It's a little on the nose, but to say sort of explicitly say like sort of this is the theme of this film.
I think it really ties everything together in an important way. And it's funny because when the movie starts,
is that in the book? First of all,
I believe it is.
Okay.
Yeah. I could be wrong about that. I'm pretty sure it's in the book though.
All right.
But there's only really like three kind of main chunks of voiceover in the film that's sort of like beginning, middle, end.
Yeah.
Everything else is without voiceover, but each time it comes in, it just has this way of really connecting and really kind of reinforcing the themes of the film. Like you said, almost outright stating them in terms of the idea about family and family like fighting with itself.
Yeah.
The idea of like the negative zone, that this place where, you know, life doesn't quite work out the way you think it should.
Mm-hmm.
And it almost feels like a mistake has been made.
Yeah.
And like you've entered into the bad timeline or something, you know, and we've all had that feeling. And the idea that some people go all the way into it and maybe never come back out again.
Yeah.
I think that's very interesting. I think it's interesting to pull that, you know, from a comic book. I mean, it just goes to show that these themes, I mean, they can be communicated in so many different mediums, and comic books can take on like serious adult themes too.
Yeah, and it's worth pointing out too, because I remember at the time when I saw it in 1997, this was pre all the superhero movies.
Right, right.
So when he was talking about the Fantastic Four and relating it to like everyday life, it was really, really cool.
Yeah, yeah. And you'd never see it done today, I don't think.
Probably nah.
By a drama, because it would just kind of be like, well, why are you referencing something that's like so ubiquitous? I think it's also interesting because Paul Hood is like 16 years old, so while he's reading like Dostoevsky in school and the idiot he's like, if you love Notes from Underground, you'll love the idiot. She's like, the idiot.
Yeah, that was great.
It reminds you in a way that he's still a kid too, but he's beginning to have more of an adult perspective on these things from childhood, that he's able to see what maybe the writers are really getting at, whereas a younger, you know, reader might just think about the fights and the cool superpowers and that sort of thing, you know.
Exactly.
But he's really starting to kind of realize that there are layers to this, and that family is this really complicated, like love it or hate it or both kind of thing.
Yeah, and it also does that thing that I love, is when a movie starts at the end.
Yes.
It's one of my favorite devices. When I've written screenplays, I've tried to use it. I've tried to force it in there.
Yeah.
And when it works, it really works.
There's something really satisfying about because it's sort of like you almost forget that beginning when you're in the flow of the movie. And then when it comes up again,
you
realize, the movie's been building back up towards itself. And now it's going to kind of finish out.
Yeah, and not in the way, because it can be done in a lot of ways. It can be done in like an action film where someone is like dying or something.
Cliffhanger
then you go back
kind of thing.
And this is not that. This is a very small little thing, which is a kid being picked up at the train station.
Yeah.
But it's, as you learn to find out, there's a lot more going on in that scene than you certainly know at the beginning.
Even in terms of whether the train has power or not, and you think about how that relates to what happens with the Elijah Wood character. You know?
Yeah, and boy, that's that shot of the train creaking to a halt.
Right,
and you've been around ice storms. The silence.
Yes,
either, and snow does the same thing. It just dampens everything.
Yeah,
and that eerily, you know, the lights went dark, and the train goes.
Yeah,
and it's just dead quiet.
Were you here in '93 when the blizzard happened? Were you like out west at that point? Or?
I was. Where was I in '93? I was in Athens. I was in college.
Okay. So do you remember that blizzard that winter?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the strongest association I have.
Yeah.
for those that are not from Georgia. Like,
right.
There was a kind of like freak blizzard that happened, I want to say around like March or something.
Yeah.
Maybe February, but I feel like it was like, you know, later in the season.
Mm-hmm.
And
it was a big party in Athens, of course.
Yeah, of course. In suburban Roswell, Georgia, it was right. A little more like
the ice storm.
Yeah. You know, no power for multiple days. And
yeah, and ice storms are weird looking too. Like, yeah. It's different than a snowstorm.
Well, there were like thunderstorms happening, so you couldn't really mm-hmm. even like go play outside in the snow. It wasn't like a fun snow.
No.
It was
just
sort of like the elements, you know.
And when the trees freeze over, it's just everything. There's a weight
to exactly.
everything. Everything feels burdened and fragile.
Right. And there's something real beautiful about it.
Yeah.
But there's also like, you know, some danger to it.
For sure.
And it's kind of, yeah, the movie does such a great job of conveying that silence.
Yeah.
With just like the wind chimes and mm-hmm. kind of the crackling of the ice in the trees as the wind blows them.
It's the title of the film, you know, for a reason.
Yeah.
It wasn't called, you know, what was the name of the family?
The Hoods.
Yeah. It wasn't called The Hoods or anything like that. It was called The Ice Storm.
Yeah. Yeah. While I'm thinking about it, the name of the other family, the Carvers.
Yeah.
In the book, they're the Williamses.
Oh, interesting.
So they changed it to the Carver, which I imagine is a reference to Raymond Carver.
Oh, you
could
think?
Be wrong, but
yeah.
I mean, I think he certainly, this film and his short stories share a lot of the same DNA kind of mm-hmm. in terms of the themes of, you know, suburban alienation.
Right.
And sort of
the everyday.
Yeah, the everyday. Carver's a little more working class, and I think this film is set in a more like kind of upper middle class milieu, but
yeah.
You know, the same underlying feeling that, you know, America is kind of a sad place with a lot of people that are lonely and alienated and so on and so forth.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of these characters. Kevin Klein, and, you know, we'll do it as we go too, but I want to talk about him for a minute.
Yes.
Ben Hood is – he's such a dope.
Yeah.
He's so dopey, but he doesn't – he's not a dummy.
No.
And those are two different things. He never – he's always trying to force something to happen unnaturally.
Yeah.
Whether it's, you know, the perfect Thanksgiving dinner or asking Wendy to say grace, which is like, she didn't want to say grace.
I love that
scene.
And
if you knew your daughter, you would know she doesn't want to say grace.
Yeah.
Like, he should have known what was coming.
They, on the commentary, they say that he's basically proceeding as if it were almost the 1950s. He has that kind of like father knows best thing going on.
Yeah, he's checked out.
But he's also at the same time, he himself is doubting and skeptical about mm-hmm. that. So sometimes he tries to play the stern father.
Yeah.
But he immediately kind of gives in.
It's all an act.
Yeah.
He is not he's always playing something.
It's like when you know, when Wendy is on the telephone in her room and he pulls the cord and she calls him
love
a fascist.
That scene.
And he goes, if I were a fascist, I would send you to military school somewhere down south, you know?
Yeah. He slams the door, go to bed, and then maybe one beat later, he opens that door.
It's like, hey, kid, it's all right, you know.
And I love their – like, he's such a dopey character, but there are a couple of great moments where that one and then obviously the one where he carries her home.
Right, yeah.
Just like –
a tear to your eye. The – yeah, and again, like the way he does that stern, like, you come with me right now, young lady, you know.
Yeah.
He really puffs his chest out.
Well, he has to do that in front of Mikey, I think.
Yeah.
And then on the way home.
As soon as he's walking home, he's like, look, kid, I don't really care.
Yeah, he's
you
like,
know?
I don't really care about that
I just
stuff.
Don't think he's right for you. Like, there's dude, pragmatic reasons.
That is one of my favorite exchanges in the movie.
Yeah.
You know, I really don't care. I just don't think he's right for you. And then he says, when you get older, you have a certain sense about whether or not things are going to work out with someone.
And whether the mess is worth it. Yeah.
Yeah, and he's fucking right, man.
He is. He's totally right there.
But he is a mess. Like, for him to be giving advice on relationships is a joke.
Yeah.
Because A, he's having an affair. B, he's so checked out that he thinks he's getting away with it.
Yeah.
You know?
He's not noticing all the signs and clues, and it's so obvious.
Yeah.
To anybody that's really observant.
And when he's finally busted, it's such a real moment because it's not a big fight.
Yeah.
It's not a, I got you, and he denies it.
Yeah.
It's very quiet and just sad.
Because she has that, she could have had that moment with the cup, the mug,
uh-huh.
you know. She could have confronted him and said, whatever, like the mug's still here, or I took the mug back, or however it is that she knows that he's lying.
Which they don't even reveal, which is kind of perfect.
Yeah. All she says is like, that stupid fucking mug, you know, she's kind of like.
I thought she was going to run and get it out of the
cupboard. Yeah, exactly.
Like that's what I think a more obvious film might have done.
Right.
But
it's like, oh, you mean this mug?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's just – yeah, and I love that they never really even use the word affair, I don't think, at least not, you know, within Benjamin and Elena. It's like she's doing the dishes. I mean, I love that there's – in that scene, it's not just two characters standing in a room – back and forth conversation. They're both kind of, they're getting ready to go out to this party.
Yeah.
She's doing the dishes. They're emptying the dishes into the trash can.
Uh-huh.
He like drops the plate when he's scraping the food off because he's on edge.
Uh-huh.
And there's
so many little moments.
Yeah, there's so much that's revealed through behavior, and it just feels so true to life that these situations never play out in like a vacuum. There's always life going on in the background.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's kind of like, you know, what are we going to do? We're going to have this big argument right now. She says to him, you know, don't start. You know, I don't think this is not going to be a good conversation. I don't think you want to have it right now or something like that.
Yeah.
They both know exactly what's going on, but they just kind of soldier on through it.
Yeah, man. And without getting too personal, a lot of this movie mirrors what I grew up with. And it is astounding and profoundly sad and depressing what some people can accept and live with for years.
Oh, it's terrifying actually that you think I have that feeling a lot when I for instance when I read like the lives of artists and so on, and so many that go on to succeed, they have these moments where they kind of make a really forceful break with the thing that they're from or the life they're living. Maybe it's a job that they quit, or, you know, they take like that really big shot. But then there's so many other people that don't do that, that just kind of say, oh, what if, or, oh, there's all these other reasons not to, and so on.
Yeah.
And it's, that's kind of where, that's how, you know, Benjamin Hood, that's how he ends up where he is, by just kind of not having the courage of his own convictions, kind of to just kind of muddle his way through his life, and to not really listen to, you know, what his heart is telling him. You know, this is not right. I don't feel this anymore. Whatever.
Yeah.
There's that moment early on when they're having the dinner party, and he's almost bragging that they're not going to couples therapy anymore, and that he's like, you know, the only real big fight we've had in years was about couples therapy itself.
Yeah, they're not fighting.
Yeah, but it's like you should be a little bit.
They're dead.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a funeral.
Yeah, it's much worse than fighting. It's just kind of
there's like a range
robot.
when you look at this. These lives that some of us grew up with and some play out in a film, from an abusive relationship that you stay in all the way to just this stage play that you can manage to do for years.
So sad.
And
so
like,
sad.
It is sad because, like, you know, get those years back.
And also the really interesting thing that the movie shows us is that, you know, the parents almost think that they're keeping up a facade. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're staying, you know, they're quote unquote staying together for the kids.
Yeah.
And that's the thing is that the kids know everything.
Yeah.
The parents don't think the kids know, but they
sure
know.
Do.
They don't miss a beat, you know.
Yeah.
When Wendy's, you know, sitting there watching Nixon on the TV, but she hears the fight happening in the kitchen.
Yep.
And there's shots of her, and you can tell that she knows. Maybe she's not hearing every word, but she hears the tone of voices, and she just knows mom and dad are fighting.
It's this again.
Yeah. And the way, like, that's like one of the first things that she talks about with her brother when he comes home. It's like, how are the parents doing? Do you think they're headed for divorce?
The parental unit.
Yeah.
Yeah, this movie really hit home for me.
And
I'm going to say.
Yeah, I remember that so much too from growing up. Like, my parents had a pretty good relationship, but
there's still fights.
There were times when there were fights, and you know, I remember like standing at the top of the stairs and hearing like, and just like that feeling of like that. That's also, I think, part of growing up in a way is realizing like, oh, this isn't picture perfect. Sometimes, you know, good people can disagree and there can be tension and so on. It's part of that, like you're losing that sort of idealized childhood view of the world, and you're coming into something much more complex and scary.
Yeah, I will say this, and again, I don't want to get into my history too much because it's just sad, but what it does is it leaves a child feeling very unmoored.
Yeah, yeah. Because those rock solid figures are not so solid anymore.
Not so solid.
Yeah.
It's a bad feeling. I love the Nixon stuff.
Yes.
And the character of Wendy, how she's it's a time where she's developing – it's a time in America with the Equal Rights Amendment and feminism. I guess – is this – which wave would this have been?
Second wave,
feminism in the early 70s.
Yeah.
And her coming into her own as a woman, because she's always the one calling the shots with the boys.
Yes.
She's the one that's saying, I'll show you mine if you show me yours.
Yeah.
Or let's get into bed together, or I'm going to take my pants down and – you can look at it, but you can't touch it. And like, she's setting the rules, and it's sort of this little proto-feminist. She's the one railing against the establishment and Nixon, and like Kevin Klein just doesn't – like what he's got on his hands is this great daughter that is going to be a fully realized woman.
Yes.
And I don't think he even realizes that.
Yeah. He – I mean, he loves his daughter. You can tell he has a genuine affection and cares for her, but at the same time – he's a little bit eye-rolly when he sees, you know.
Sure. It's like, he's not really listening.
No. He's like, all right, can we cut it with a, you know, presidential assassination talk or.
Yeah. It's again, he's playing. He's like, this is what I should say.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not, I don't think he ever really speaks from his heart.
No.
Except
in moments,
a couple of moments.
He'll drop the facade once in a while. But
yeah.
But then he kind of, maybe because he feels exposed, he kind of puts that armor back up again, and he's back into you know, robot dad.
Well, mode. when he finally gets busted for real again, you know, we talked about it a second ago that it's not some big fight.
Yeah,
and he very just sadly just says, "I don't even feel good about it."
Yeah, yeah.
Like he's like, that's
it's not
the truth.
It's not
of
what
matter.
You think. It's not some big plot.
Yeah,
because she thinks that they've coordinated this whole thing,
right?
The keys and so on.
And it's not. It's not satisfying.
He's just
for him.
Like he's just like no. It's it, you know. It's just a dumb thing that happened, mm-hmm. really. And
but that's the truth.
Yeah,
he doesn't have a relationship with Sigourney Weaver's character.
But it's funny because Ang Lee makes this observation on the commentary that, you know, the kind of stereotypical midlife crisis,
mm-hmm.
a guy like Benjamin Hood might date a much younger woman, for instance. In this case, he's dating like someone around his age from the neighborhood that has kids.
I think it's convenient.
Yeah, exactly. It's the convenience is the biggest thing. But when they are in bed, he starts talking about like the guy at his work that's taking private golf lessons.
It's that
and
dopey
so on.
Thing. He's so unaware.
But he's slipping into that almost like marriage-like territory where he's like unloading about his day-to-day boring shit. And she's just like,
you're
boring
line.
Me. I've got a husband. I don't particularly need another. You
yeah,
know?
It's such a great line.
So it's interesting that he is almost trying to connect in a way, in his dopey way.
He's trying to make a connection.
Yeah.
It happens all over this film.
Yeah.
Ham-fistedly, unsuccessfully almost always, people are trying to make connections.
Yeah.
Joan Allen, I mean, what a role and what an acting job she does.
Yes.
You know, she is in a loveless marriage.
Mm-hmm.
She's going through the motions of this stage play that she lives every day.
Yeah.
And that moment when she sees Wendy on the bicycle.
I know.
Is
it's almost like dreamlike or something. It's kind of, you know, she's seeing this like, it's like she's time traveling, you know, back to when she was that young and that free and everything.
And she immediately, she just can't help herself. She says, I haven't been on a bike in years.
Yeah.
It's like instinct took over and she just had to say that out loud.
Yeah.
And
her going to shoplift, you know, the drugstore.
There's so many moments like that bike scene that are so small but so impactful.
Yeah.
And this movie, like more than many movies I've seen, do a lot with a little.
Yeah, the minimalist kind of approach is so important. The restraint, the fact that these moments are just allowed to unfold, you know, without commentary, without kind of emphasis, even that we're in a way, because reading the first chapter of the book again, you have it's basically the scene where Benjamin Hood is in the guest room at the Carvers, he's waiting for Sigourney Weaver to come back. And,
which is hysterical
because,
again, he's so dopey and unaware.
Yeah.
She ain't coming back.
Right.
Everyone in the theater knows she's not coming back. And he's like, well, I guess she just stepped out for a minute.
Yeah. In the book, you know, you're sort of inside the perspective of his mind, his thoughts and so on. And so you're getting these little vignettes from all throughout his life.
Mm-hmm.
And he's thinking back in the book, he's had a previous affair with somebody from like the office Christmas party where they had really bad sex in a car one time.
Uh-huh.
I think that's probably the model for
the bad sex in the car.
Yeah. I believe they kind of transposed that a little bit, but
It's a great device.
Yeah, but I think it's so interesting because the novel is so interior facing in terms of you're just in somebody's thoughts in its stream of conscious the way they're thinking,
mm-hmm.
and it's something that would be nearly impossible to adapt, you would think,
mm-hmm.
and the way that it's adapted here is so different because the film is much more about surfaces,
mm-hmm.
and about being somewhat distant and outside the thing,
right.
but being able to see enough inside to know what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
But it's sort of like the tip of the iceberg that we're seeing,
right.
you know, and there's so much submerged beneath that we
right.
don't see that we only can kind of intuit from what we are seeing.
It is in the book.
It is in the book.
Right.
It's kind of him just feeling like I'm 39, I'm losing my hair, like
yeah, but you get all
I'm in this marriage we haven't had sex in 2 years.
Right.
And, he's thinking about, you know, when he first met his wife back in college, and even then he kind of it's so sad because they meet at like a college party. He's really drunk.
Uh-huh.
He starts talking to her, and it's almost like he wants to stop talking, but through like social awkwardness or pressure or something, he just continues.
Yeah.
And that's almost how their relationship starts, was his almost like inability to act or to do something.
Uh-huh.
He just kind of like sleepwalks his way through his entire life.
Yeah.
You know, he just bumbles into this marriage and kids
yeah.
and the job and everything else is just kind of he's not somebody that's acting with any kind of intention. He's just kind
yeah.
of, oh, I guess this is what I'm supposed to do.
Right.
You know?
No intention, no awareness.
Yeah.
It's really interesting.
Yeah.
Speaking of subtle moments and the fact that Ang Lee just plays it all so like real is the moment early on at the dinner party when the wine is spilled.
Oh, yeah.
On Kevin Kline's lap.
Cleaning and there's up the stain.
Yeah, there's that really quick thing where Sigourney Weaver is the one that jumps up
yeah.
to dab his
pants.
His
crotch.
Pants.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it didn't even have to be the crotch.
Just kind of down somewhere low. And yeah,
and
Joan Allen.
Yeah, she has that moment where she sees it.
Where
yeah.
she sees like they're a little familiar, they're a little comfortable.
Yeah, yeah, but I get the feeling that she already knew.
Oh, yeah.
And this was just further confirmation, right? Right?
Yeah, I think
okay.
so too.
That's what I thought.
That's definitely not the first sign of trouble. I love that scene also a little bit later on when Kevin Kline leans in to kiss Joan Allen, tell her he's going to go to bed early,
mm-hmm.
and she notices his aftershave is different.
Yeah,
and he tries to play it off. He's
right.
like, "Oh yeah, it is a new aftershave.
It's
I think
musk.
It's called musk." and he just kind of like wanders off, you know.
Yeah,
and her, if you just like really sit on her reaction, which the camera does. Sits on her reaction and just – if you just look at the subtle changes in her face, like
uh-huh.
you can see everything that she understands completely that everything that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But she's like balancing her checkbook and she just tears out a new check and kind of like shoves it all down and just moves on, you know?
Yeah, because the bills still have to get paid
yeah.
and the dishwasher still has to get loaded.
Right, right.
And that's like that brutal thing that, you know, life has to go on.
Yeah, yeah.
In the face of this – just void
yeah,
that just you're living
unbearable,
in.
Unbearable, you know, when it kind of, you know, when the void kind of exposes itself in that way.
Yeah,
when we become aware of it.
As an audience member, you so want someone, maybe because you're conditioned in films to see this, but you so want her to smash the plate.
Exactly.
And to start screaming at him.
Yeah.
And that's not the reality of it, though, man.
No.
Like, this is how it goes a lot of times.
It's the lives of a quiet desperation, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Elijah Wood's character, Mikey, seeing it again as an older person, I was like, does he have a diagnosis?
I think
because when I was – before, yeah. I was just like, oh, he's just the weird kid.
Yeah.
But, like, Sigourney Weaver even has that –
Well, the
Mikey's been out of it since he was born.
Yeah, the father says, I guess he kind of takes after his dad, you know?
Yeah, but it's also light. And I think I think it might be like maybe Asperger's
exactly,
or something.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. I could definitely see that.
Which you would play it in 1973 for like just a quirky kid.
Yeah.
He's out of it.
Nobody
half
knew
the time.
Back then.
Yeah.
So to look for those signs or to kind of recognize
that football moment on the field
yeah,
where he just like
totally zones out.
Yeah, he zones out and
yeah.
the ball falls. And but then, you know. And perhaps it is Asperger's because he's very smart
yeah.
and very into the idea of geometry when he's explaining. And that's one of my favorite scenes, actually,
yeah.
when he's explaining to Sandy why he loves geometry and math and about space.
Cubes. And
he's trying yeah. to make a connection.
Yeah.
And what is Sandy's response?
I just need to do my homework.
Yeah. I just needed help with my math.
Yeah.
Like it's such a like real moment between It's like exactly how it would go down.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's very telling that he is interested in geometry, because it's this kind of abstract thing that's not really related. I mean, it is related to the material world, but it's also not, because it's kind of – there's perfection in geometry and there's no perfection in the world, you know? And, you know, I mean, he says as much. He's like, you know, you can't really have like a perfect shape or a perfect cube in, you know, in terms of space in reality, but you can in your mind. And so he's interested in this kind of other world where, you know, mathematics is kind of a – it's like a self-contained perfect system. Like everything adds up and everything – there's no like ambiguity per se. I mean obviously once you get higher into like theoretical stuff –
yeah, but
then yes,
math is about proofs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And life is all about gray zone and, you know, ambivalence. So yeah, it's very interesting that he has this kind of it's almost like he's looking for something. He's finding maybe that sense of security or stability, permanence in this kind of, you know, mathematic form. But but it's ultimately you know, it can't be reconciled with reality.
Yeah,
and he kind of pays like the ultimate price for that.
Yeah, and in that scene, I felt so much empathy for both of those boys
trying to connect. But
I felt bad for Mikey because he's not able to connect with his brother on this thing that's important to him. And I felt bad for Sandy because he's just this kid. He doesn't know what he's talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
He's talking about this abstract time and space and geometry. Yeah. And Sandy just wants help with his math.
They're just a few too many years apart you know, at that point to make that connection. And then, of course, the dad comes home right in the middle, you know, immediately following that.
Oh, God, that brutal
and
line.
That horrible, like.
Remember the line from Mikey? He's like,
you were gone?
You were gone.
Yeah.
I'm back, fellas. You were gone.
And then he just kind of laughs. He's like, yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
And that's got to sting though, man.
He talks about, you know, semiconductors and silicon and
trying to make a connection.
And then again,
can't do it.
Just zero interest on the part of the kids, because it's pretty boring to a kid, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And just an awkward silence and like, well, see you later. You know?
Right.
It's just, oh.
God damn, this movie is fucking devastating.
It is brutal. Yeah.
The clandestine love between Wendy and Mikey is so sweet. I remember those early days, like, you know, when they met in the empty
– the pool.
Pool to, like, kiss each other and make
it's
out.
It's funny because it's not even really romantic what they're doing.
It feels like they're trying to learn stuff.
They're experimenting, yeah. They're just sort of like, you're curious, I'm curious, let's try this and see what this is.
That's
because
exactly what it is.
It seems like adults are doing this and it seems like something that – older people care about a lot, and you know, it's in movies and so on. So let's see what this is all about.
I was too scared to do that stuff, Casey.
I was too.
A late bloomer.
Oh yeah, same. So it was, you know, but there's almost something mechanical about the way they're going about it, the way they're making out, and then the way the camera kind of booms up and cranes and you
it's a great shot.
Yeah, the leaves on the, you know, the bottom of the swimming pool and the sense of isolation, the fact that it's an empty pool and all that just kind of hammers home that, again, these are people looking for connection.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, so much of what the movie's about is, you know, on one level it's about sex, but on a deeper level it's about people using sex to try to connect and sort of not getting that result from it, you know, instead just kind of having –
it happens
sort of
over and over
empty
and over.
Experiences that don't really ultimately achieve any kind of true connection or
Well, I mean, Paul, you know, eventually when they get to the parallel stories of Paul in the city, trying to connect with Libitz.
Yeah.
Libitz. What kind of a name is Libitz? the same thing, misconnections.
Yeah. Oh yeah. That painful moment where, you know, he's trying to he's saying, like, I feel a real connection to you. And she's like, I do too. And then he can say it before she says it. You know, she's like a brother, you know.
Brother.
And he's like, yeah, you're not alone in that opinion.
Oh, God. It's just the worst. And then one of my favorite lines in the movie, and a really clever line, is when he goes, you want to take a bath together?
Yeah, I love that. I love that. He almost kind of pulls it off there.
Almost.
Yeah.
It was very funny.
Yeah.
Before we get into more of the movie itself, let's talk about the score.
Oh yes, Michael Dana.
Who is it?
Michael Dana, who works a lot with Adam McGoyan.
Oh, okay.
You know, Canadian filmmaker.
Yeah.
And
did he do like The Sweet Hereafter by chance?
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is a beautiful score.
Yeah.
And also an equally crushing film, mm-hmm. if not more even.
Yeah. Another, was that a wintertime film
yes.
too, I think?
Oh, yeah, because it's a school bus and
yeah,
all that.
Yeah, sort of reminds me of this. Two different movies for sure. But.
No, but it could be a good double feature.
Yeah.
If you just want to be insanely depressed.
If you want to wreck yourself.
Yeah. But yeah, Michael Dana, he's worked with also like Terry Gilliam,
mm-hmm.
Mira Nair. He's Adam Egoyan, like he works with him over and over and over.
What is that? Egoyan still doing stuff?
He is, yeah.
Really?
He's kind of
he used to be one of my favorites, man, yeah. And I kind of lost track.
He has a film every couple years.
Really?
Yeah, but he's kind of like I haven't seen one recently.
They're more low profile, right?
Yeah, they're much more low profile. I think, you know, they play festivals, but they don't really play like the first run of like
Art House,
Cannes, Venice, uh-huh. Toronto, et cetera. They're kind of like second.
That's a shame.
Yeah. It's, but I really need to catch up because he is somebody that, you know, even pre-Sweet Hereafter, he has a whole like 80s, 90s, like, you know, very, very kind of bold, strong stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he's kept at it. So.
What was the one about the missing girl?
Is that Exotica? I don't know.
Yes.
Yeah? Okay.
Exotica.
That's the only one I've seen. It's been a really long time. I barely remember that movie other than like the strip club mm-hmm. and Ilias Kateas and
– yeah, who was one of his guys
that
he would go back to. The score in this movie is just so great. There's sort of some lush string stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But what really stands out to me is that I don't even know what instrument that is.
It's called gamelan. I mean, it's not the name of the instrument, but the genre of music, the drums, the kind of percussion.
Yeah, and there's some wind instrument.
Yeah, well, that's a Native American flute.
Okay, is it a flute?
Yeah, being played by like a somebody who practices that tradition.
Yeah,
Native American guy.
Boy, it really fits.
Oh yeah, it's got a real like soulfulness to it.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's kind of like, in a way, it's like the movie exposes that kind of emotion. You know,
it's stark and it's sad, and it just somehow fits that.
There's like a longing to it.
Forest of. And maybe that's part of it, you know, Native American with the forest and the tree setting.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The natural settings.
Well, it's like, you know, what Wendy says at Thanksgiving, you know, and what even Thanksgiving is about.
Yeah.
Or versus what we think it's about versus what the reality was and uh-huh. so on and so forth.
That seems great.
So, yeah, in a way, it's not something that the film hammers home, but there is that slight subtext of like these people are living – you know, the American experiment has been around for a couple – well, they're coming up on the bicentennial.
Yeah,
they're 3 years out. And, 200 years of this country and everything that transpired for this country, mm-hmm. America, to be here. And the way that Wendy brings it up at Thanksgiving and
so
they're just
great.
Like, all right,
yeah.
You know, never mind, pass the – turkey or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Give me the great – Paul, would you like a roll?
Yeah.
It's amazing how quickly they're all able to brush – and go back to the stage play
exactly,
that they're living.
Exactly. It's like, come on, don't make this any harder than it is. You know?
Right.
Let's just get through this.
Because this is supposed to be the easy Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Because even says
grandma's not.
Yeah.
Even though we miss her.
Right.
I love that. Yeah. It's like, you know, of course we still miss her, but you know,
because he feels like he needs to say
yeah.
that again.
Yeah.
Christina Ricci is so good in this movie.
It's amazing.
Like
yeah.
I've been a fan of hers her whole career. Off and on, things she's made have been really good, but like, I don't know if she got her due as an actor.
No, really, she didn't. I love Buffalo 66.
Yeah,
that's another one I could do for the show.
But she is so good in this
performance
movie.
In that one, and yeah, she just I don't know what it is about her. She has such a compelling kind of presence on screen. Her face can do so much, you know, can emote so well.
Yeah,
and she has this intensity. And I mean, it's so good to play kind of like the smarter beyond her years kind of
mm-hmm.
teenager character.
Mm-hmm.
She's just, I think she was maybe 16 when they were filming this and she's playing like maybe 14 or so.
Yeah.
It's completely believable. She's certainly one of the highlights of the film.
Yeah. The scene, you know, we mentioned it before when, he carries her home, like,
how she can kind of go from, you know, playing at adult.
Burgeoning sexuality.
Yeah,
to like
she's reverting back to
5-year-old
childhood.
All of a sudden. She wraps her legs around him.
Yeah.
And the reverse of that they do that great reverse on both her faces when their necks are cradled into one another.
Yeah.
And it's just like fucking heartbreaking.
Oh, yeah.
Because,
yeah.
I mean, you know, I hope you have kids one day. There's the constant from the second they're born, you immediately start fearing them going away.
Right. Yeah. That push-pull between like wanting to see them flourish and become
astoundingly fast
a grown-up and at the same time saying, no, wait, come back. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's amazing how fast it sets in of, oh, no, you're going to leave me one day.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ugh, God. Can't even go there, Casey. Jesus Christ. Be a weepy mess on this fucking show. But
start,
that scene
to think of that Beatles song, She's Leaving Home or something. You know?
Yeah. Oh, stop it. What are you trying to do to me here? But, you know, they're able to, in that brief moment, to make that connection. I feel like Joan Allen never gets to make that connection with Wendy, at
least. Wendy tries to connect with her mom. There's that scene where she says to her mom, they're in the kitchen, and she goes, Mom, are you all right?
Yeah.
And she goes, no, it's fine, you know. And
well, however, though, in that scene, she's trying to explain to Wendy the feeling that she got when she saw her on the bike.
Yes.
And she's saying this deep thing.
Yeah.
That's her.
That's true. And
her
Wendy's not
geometry
really
conversation.
Picking up on that. Yeah, that's true.
And Wendy's just sort of like, are you all right?
Yeah.
Like there's no like, oh, man, Mom, that must have felt really special.
Yeah, they are kind of missing each other. They're both trying to connect, and it's just not happening.
Everyone is missing each other through this whole fucking movie. It's so frustrating.
But that line that she has, Mom, are you all right?
Yeah.
This concept that they talk about on the commentary of, you know, children raising their parents.
Yeah.
You know, of
especially back then.
Yeah, of you know, this like you said, the parents are kind of playing at being children, and the children are playing at being adults. And this generation, you know, kind of fell weirdly in between.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's not fully the 70s yet. It's not the 60s anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They're just kind of like they're stranded in the middle, sort of. And it seems like they have they're going to revert or not revert, but they're going to go towards they're going to want more stability.
Yeah.
You know? They're going to grow up to be maybe more like traditional sort of parents, let's mm-hmm. say, a little more strict, a little bit more like watchful of their kids, let's say,
mm-hmm.
because their childhoods are coming out of this like permissiveness and indifference almost.
Yeah. Indifference.
And, yeah. And so they're going to kind of, the pendulum's going to swing in the other direction for them.
Yeah. And this is sort of, again, something that I can relate to. And I think it was sort of the time is that parents can be so consumed with their own shit.
Yeah.
Back then, especially,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's probably swung too far in the other direction now, but
whole helicopter thing.
Yeah. But the these kids are sort of on their own.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was that's coming from. It's sort of like the zeitgeist at that moment.
Yeah,
there's all the new agey stuff, the self help, the kind of like, you know, quote unquote spirituality that's not necessarily religious per se. But
especially for the women of that era, because they're coming out of the 50s and 60s,
where
women were truly, you know, subjective to their husbands.
Yeah.
And the early 70s and I think probably late 60s was when some of that first started. Some of these that's when all those books, and there's that great shot of when she's looking at the table.
Yeah.
When there were so many books for women to like reclaim your life,
right,
basically.
Right. Reclaim your life.
Be a whole person.
Exactly. And sort of give proper attention to all these things that you've put aside
mm-hmm.
for all these years. At the behest of your husband or at the behest of your children or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's this kind of thing where they are trying to grow as people. They're trying to become more fully rounded mm-hmm. adults and so on.
Equal.
Full, yeah, equal and just have like a full, rich life, mm-hmm. not just a life of like servitude.
That's right.
And but at the same time, there is like this, you know, maybe the pendulum going too far in terms of the parents. Like, you know, when Wendy mentions in passing that she's like in band
uh-huh.
and both, you know, her mom is just sort of like, oh, I thought you weren't in band anymore.
Yeah.
She's like, well, you know,
they don't even know.
It's not a big deal. And,
yeah.
you know, I only play a few notes anyway, like,
right.
because she doesn't hear rehearsing, practicing anymore.
Uh-huh.
But it's because she just plays like the same three notes over and over.
Yeah.
And, just that sense that it would be unthinkable today, certainly for most parents to not know, what kind of extracurriculars their kids are involved in. And,
it's,
you know,
unthinkable.
It's, yeah. So, yeah, but at the same time, I think I do know that there are people from that generation that are certainly nostalgic for that style of childhood. That kind of there was a recent kind of article or trend about this, like the idea of like free range parenting.
Yeah, yeah, we did an episode on that.
Okay, yeah, yeah. So it's the idea that, for instance, you know, a kid that's maybe no older than like 10 to 12 or something could like live in New York City, take the subway, go to like, you know, some CD theater and like watch like an R-rated movie.
Or that you would let your 10-year-old walk to the playground in your neighborhood by themselves.
Sure, sure. Yeah. So just – and the fact that, you know, we're way pre-cell phone. There's, there's not this constant line of communication that can be opened up between the parent and child.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like you know, in that scene where Kevin Kline is leaving the house to go pick up Paul at and he says to Wendy, "What have you been doing?" She goes, "Nothing." You know, typical teenager answer.
Yeah,
but it's like they don't know. They don't want to know necessarily. I mean, they make the effort in a way, at least
sort of.
They kind of play at it. Yeah, they play at it. But they just don't know what's going on in their kids' lives, really.
Yeah. Oh, well, and when he does pick him up in the car, you know, on the way home, that conversation between Paul and
talk,
Ben.
Yeah.
I mean, and at first though, it's just no. Yes.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
And then, you know, well, it's probably a good time to have that talk.
Yeah.
Self-abuse.
Self-abuse.
On the self-abuse front.
Yes. Oh, man.
And again, it's just there's no connections being made.
But it's a funny button on that scene where they pull into the driveway. He's like, "Paul, could you do me a favor and pretend I never said any of that to you?"
And
he's like,
"Yeah." Sure. And you get the, you know, it's not like it's a movie you can look at and say like, they don't have a good relationship, Paul and Ben.
Yeah.
It's not that. It's just they just don't have much of anything.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Which is maybe the saddest thing of all.
Absolutely. They're just kind of, they're two strangers, basically. You would think they were acquaintances or something rather than like, you know, father and son.
Yeah. And, you know, they don't have many funny moments. There are a couple of like the waterbed.
Yeah.
They play that for laughs a little
bit. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
But aside from that, they kind of just play the 70s fairly straight.
Yeah. It's certainly not like going over the top with like just the kind of cliches that we associate with that period.
Yeah.
It's not a cartoon version of the 70s.
No, not at all.
It's a very lived in. There are still some of those familiar signposts. I think we see a lava lamp in somebody's room at some point.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's not like, you know, underlined or
it's
anything.
It's not that 70s show.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
What is your take on the – let's talk about the preacher for a minute.
Sure.
Who – I didn't look up that actor.
Yeah, I didn't either.
I don't
He's
know
very
that
good.
I've ever seen him, but he was really good
yeah,
in this.
Yeah,
you know, the sort of long-haired, you know
– That's a wig too.
Progressive.
When they're talking in the when she's at that table of books.
Yeah.
There's a – you know, it's kind of a windy day.
Yeah.
And so like the wind kind of blows his hair back and Ang Lee is talking about he just like during the scene, he kind of reaches up and brushes his hair back behind his ear, which to Ang Lee anyway was like a great performance choice because it kind of shows that he's like this. He's had this has this kind of vanity to him.
Yeah, right.
That he's kind of like posing, you know,
right.
He's sort of aware of how he's coming off and he has this kind of cockiness to him.
Yeah.
Even though he's trying to also present himself as like the enlightened one.
Yeah, I thought that was a really
interesting. Very full of himself.
Yeah, I thought like just having him in the film at all was an interesting choice.
And there was more of him.
Was there apparently a scene in the film? Or?
Yeah, yeah, in the film. Apparently, there was another scene between between him and Elena where they're like in a cafe and they're talking. And you know, from their description, it was a good scene, but it just kind of. The tone maybe deviated a little too much from the film. They talked a lot about on the commentary about how there were sort of numerous scenes and moments that on their own are really great and funny, but it just, you know, in their words, it kind of made the ending too unbearable.
Right.
To vacillate from these moments of levity and then still end so darkly.
I thought they really nailed the tone.
Yeah,
whatever they ended up with was kind of perfect.
Yeah,
yeah.
It stays pretty well in that mood, and but yeah, the preacher character,
he's seeking a connection too. It's all over this movie.
Oh yeah, he feels probably as lost as or maybe more. I mean, the people that he's so desperate to kind of connect or to find something that's meaningful to him that he's kind of. Oriented his whole life towards that, you know, towards this kind of life of being a new agey spiritual guru, whatever you want to call it, you know?
Yeah. And in the end, it's such a great payoff for that character. He ends up at the key party,
yeah,
which we'll get to in just a second.
Sure.
And ends up shamed into leaving.
Yeah.
But he, you know, that line when he says, even the shepherd needs the company of the flock from time to time or whatever.
Yeah.
And boy, she just eviscerates him.
She's like, I'm going to try very hard not to understand the implication of that statement.
Fuck, dude.
Just like,
oof. Like, I didn't see that coming.
Yeah.
I remember the first time I saw that, I thought she would have understood maybe.
Yeah.
Because she's in a similar place.
Right.
Where she needs a connection. And she has gone without sex.
Right.
Clearly in her own marriage.
Yeah.
Although they do it.
Yeah, that is true. There's the first scene where Kevin Kline tries to initiate.
Mm-hmm.
He has that great performance where his hand kind of reaches over her in bed and she goes, Ben.
Yeah, yeah.
And he just pulls it back and his hand kind of trembles and
yep.
he just, you know, rolls back over and goes to sleep.
But they do make love.
Yeah, but they do. Well,
it's implied at least.
But they do it at a moment where they're about to say something.
Yeah.
And she actually says to him, like, Ben, maybe no talking right now.
Mm-hmm.
And then they almost have sex as a way of diffusing
yeah.
whatever was about to transpire between
Absolutely.
Them.
Absolutely.
So,
yeah.
you know, it's not really – I mean, they're making a sort of connection, but they're not
– Not really,
they're
though.
Using it to, you know, to stave off, like, whatever big blow up is going to –
Yes.
You know, yeah.
You definitely get the picture that afterward it wasn't like, oh, my God, we've reconnected
yeah,
again
yeah.
and we're on the right track.
But I love that moment when Wendy's coming up the stairs. You know, her dad's come down the stairs and he's kind of doing up the last button on his
yeah.
And
then she sees the mussed up bed.
Yeah, exactly. And there's no spoken words or anything. But again, it's one of those moments where, you know, you realize like, oh, my parents do kind of have like a sexual relationship,
right.
and that's weird and uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And, you know, all those conflicted feelings you have.
Well, speaking of weird and uncomfortable, nice transition into the bathroom scene with Sandy and Wendy.
Oh yes.
It's just like, has there ever been a more real,
yeah.
brutal depiction of like young adolescent hormonal,
yeah.
like confusion?
Exactly. Not knowing. I mean, he says to her, he's like, "What do you want? What do you want?" You know.
Well, because
neither one of them
yeah.
knows what they want really.
God, and his little hands are trembling. I just
yeah.
felt like I wanted to yank him out of there and just give him a hug.
I know.
It was so brutal to see this kid so scared.
Yeah.
And then that's when you get the great exchange with Sigourney Weaver.
Yes.
Afterwards.
Yes. But yeah, the look on both of their faces. I don't know how they got that performance out of that kid.
Man,
you know,
he was good.
Yeah,
little man Tate.
Because they have to.
That's who that was.
Yeah,
yeah.
Because I think I mean this is a common thing in movies that have like really adult themes, mm-hmm. but have to involve like very young actors.
Right.
Oftentimes there will be like a parallel scene that mm-hmm. the kid thinks they're playing, that is you know that diverges wildly from
right.
the real. Substance of the thing.
Yeah.
I know like in particular like in The Shining, Danny, you know, he in a lot of those scenes he was kind of enacting mm-hmm. a different scenario than
Yeah, cuz you just need a reaction that's
yeah,
believable.
Exactly.
Yeah, I always wonder in movies like this like at the premiere when these kids like when that little kid goes to the premiere it's like
yeah.
what does he think of the ice storm?
Well, it's like can he even watch it? You know, does
well,
he have to wait until he's older?
Yeah, yeah. sometimes they can't.
Yeah. Or does he have to see like a you know, just a highlight reel or something?
Right.
Like, these are the scenes of yours that are okay.
Yeah. Although, I mean, there's nothing overtly, I mean, there's the bad sex scene in the car.
Yeah.
And there's some, but there's no explicit sex going
no,
on.
No, there's like no real like nudity or anything. There's just kind of people fumbling around.
But a kid certainly wouldn't understand this
yeah.
movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like
yeah.
way above.
It might be kind of like lost on.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah.
Again, to the relationship with the siblings, with Wendy and Paul, it's just like when they call each other Charles.
Charles, yeah.
And that's such a nice little touch.
Yes.
You know, this little thing that they have together. And I have siblings and again, with my upbringing, like there's a definite connection that happens with siblings when you grow up in a house with parents that are not –
yeah,
in love,
you're more bonded. It's sort of like yeah,
there's a thing
yeah.
that happens, and then the saddest thing ever, and of course this movie can't cover it. Well, it sort of does because he's gone to prep school.
Mm-hmm.
Is especially when you're the youngest,
when one ages out.
Yeah, my sister
gone.
Aged out.
Yeah,
and then it was me and my brother.
Yeah,
and he aged out and
oh,
went to
man.
College, and then it was
yeah.
just me.
Yeah,
and my worst years were after my brother left.
Yeah,
and that's
yeah.
no coincidence.
Sure,
you
sure.
know?
Yeah, Wendy has that feeling. It's almost like there's like a moment where Paul has left to go to Manhattan to go to the party,
mm-hmm.
And now it's just Wendy and the two parents, and
yeah.
they don't even talk. Mm-hmm. And she gets up from the table without asking to be excused or anything. She just, you know, walks off into the kitchen,
oh, yeah.
kind of vaguely pissed off looking.
Yeah.
Grabs like a snack from the fridge uh-huh. and then just like walks past.
That's
again.
A great moment.
Zero interaction, acknowledgement, nothing.
Nothing.
And yeah, you have that. You really have that sense that she feels like stranded.
Yeah.
And that she's just waiting, counting down the days till she can get out.
Yeah, yeah, and there's not a lot of use of popular music in this film, but there's a couple of key ones.
Yeah.
The Manhattan scene when Leave On by Elton John plays.
Yes, yes.
And then in the scene we were just talking about with when Paul first gets home,
yeah.
Jim Croce's I've Got a Name
yeah.
is in the background.
Yeah.
And they have that great moment at the end of the scene after they've said everything, the record skips.
Yeah.
And he goes, Charles, is that my record?
You've been touching my shit.
You've been touching my shit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I love that.
But it's not adversarial.
No,
it's like
no.
very loving.
He's just like, I knew you were coming in my room because
yeah.
it's fine. You know, it's there, really. It's her way of, you know, kind of connecting with her brother, being around her brother when
yeah.
he's not there in a way.
You yeah,
know,
yeah.
He still has his things there.
I also thought it was interesting, too, how the when kind of one of the next things is when Kevin Kline busts the kids. And we've already talked about the walk home and all that.
Right, right.
But when he gets home, he's just like, he's got his chest puffed out, brushing his teeth, telling his wife about it.
That's a great
like,
shot,
well,
too.
Here's what happened.
Yeah.
And I took care of it.
Yeah.
And he doesn't realize that he's fucking busting himself.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the whole time.
He's so oblivious.
She's going.
Why the fuck were you at their
yeah.
house, you know?
And she finally says
there?
In the end, yeah. what were you doing in their basement?
Yeah.
Oh, you know.
That cup, the mug.
The mug, yeah. the coffee mug.
Yeah.
And he's just so oblivious.
That's a really, really interesting shot, the way it's framed. Because
yeah.
in the middle of the shot, you have like a you know door frame looking into the bathroom. The camera's in the bedroom. They have like a you know floor-to-ceiling mirror mm-hmm. on the right side of the door frame. And that's where you see Joan Allen in that reflection.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very interesting because you're seeing both of their faces and they're looking at each other.
Yeah.
And you know they're on opposite planes, but most of the scene plays out with her in that reflection. It's not until later on that she steps in where you can see her shoulder.
Yeah.
You know, the camera's kind of going over her shoulder a little bit. Just showing, I mean, there's so many places in the film where he plays with, you know, people being separated and kind of
yeah.
left alone in the frame or disconnected somehow or there's so much like glass, you know, and kind of these surfaces that are like transparent but do separate and are not really broken through.
Yeah, it's preventing the connection.
Yeah, yeah.
It is a very quietly sort of beautiful film cinematography wise because it's not flashy at all.
No.
And they don't even have, you know, even a movie that's not flashy can have like these beautiful sunsets or
right,
something.
Right, right, right.
Like there's really none of that.
No.
But there's a lot going on.
There's like
it's very thoughtful.
I think there's like a handful of shots that I consciously notice in the film. Like one would be that crane coming up, you know, when they're kissing. Another one that's probably my favorite shot of the film is where Elijah Wood is wearing that red coat, whatever you want to call it. And he goes to leave the house and there's a shot from inside the house, focused on a window with raindrops and you just see this red blob move in the background.
It's the frozen window.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
I love that shot.
And, but
that
there's not too many shots like that in the film. It's very, very sparingly used.
Yeah.
It's not a film where I'm thinking from scene to scene, man, this is so well shot or
yeah.
like that's such an inventive framing.
You can tell.
But when you force yourself to kind of look at it in that way, you do realize there's a whole lot going on that level as well.
Yeah.
It just works so well that you don't even consciously notice it.
Yeah, and that window is starting to freeze. It's that moment where and this is the moment where we are in the film is that great part where the weather lady talks about the impending storm.
Yeah.
And it's all very, you know, obviously metaphorical.
Right.
But that really just sets up that whole last part of the movie. Paul sets off for New York.
Right.
The weather is coming in. That brutal cold wetness and silence that like everyone who's ever – certainly if you've lived in the Northeast, but anyone who's ever been in like a storm like this is just so evocative. And that leads right to the key party.
And right before we get to the key party, I do just want to say – the cinematographer of this film, Frederick Elms, great cinematographer in his own right. He begins his career with David Lynch. He shoots Eraserhead.
Oh, wow.
And even pre-Eraserhead, which took them 5 years to make. Mm-hmm. So that's – it wasn't like a traditional film. It was like they were living in that set and, you know, just spending years and years of their lives to make this film.
Yeah.
But even before that, he had shot one of David Lynch's very first short films, mm-hmm. experimental short film called The Amputee.
Oh, wow.
And he – but he goes on to shoot like Blue Velvet mm-hmm. and Wild at Heart and – on and on and on. So he's also worked with like Jim Jarmusch, Todd Solondz, and Charlie Kaufman. He shot Synecdoche, New York.
Really?
Which is one of my all-time favorites, that film
too. Yeah, that movie confounded me.
Do you only see it one time?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
I need to see it again, huh?
Yeah. Talk about depressing movies.
Yeah, that one bears repeat
that viewing. One, that one might be the uber depressed movie. But anyway, he also shot a film called River's Edge.
Which, oh, I love River's
Edge. You know that film?
Edge.
Yeah, I love that film. Kind of Lynchian in its own way.
Yeah, who directed that?
Tim Hunter.
What else has he done?
He did a film called Tex with
Matt Dillon.
Matt Dillon, yeah.
Okay, that was a good movie too.
And he directed some episodes of Twin Peaks.
It's a lot of teen angst.
Yeah, exactly. I think that was kind of his wheelhouse.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what he's really done beyond
that. River's
that.
Edge was so good.
But River's Edge is fantastic.
Like, very underrated too.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one. So now, you know, once you get to the key part, you start cross-cutting, and it's such a great editing job. And editing, you know, doesn't have to be flashy to be, like, super effective. And I think this is a great example of that.
Oh, yeah.
Of great editing is the cross-cutting between the key party, the Manhattan party, and then Wendy and Mikey and Sandy's story and what's going on.
Yeah.
And that's one of my favorite thing in movies when you have these parallel storylines.
Yes.
And, you know how it is in the editing room, like – how long you stay in each place is can vary, and it's like it's not math. It's like it's gut and it's emotional.
Yeah,
like when you decide to leave each place to go to the next.
When you're watching it, just as a viewer, you're not necessarily appreciating even how difficult that is mm-hmm. to find the rhythm, the right rhythm, how long to stay in these places. Because I'm sure they had no shortage of great material from that party, especially
absolutely,
and how to. How to just like focus in on what is essential and what can be cut, you know, and what's slowing mm-hmm. the movie down and so on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a more indulgent filmmaker could have just let that stuff run and run and run, and it all would have been very entertaining, I'm sure. But at a certain point, it would have been working at cross purposes with the film itself, what it's saying. And so, it's one of those films that does feel like it's paced just right.
Just right.
It never has that moment really where I feel like things have slowed down or it's just kind of stuck. It's always progressing, and the urgency with the storm and everything is like ratcheting up every moment.
Yeah, but it's still languid.
Yeah,
It manages, like, it's a bit of a magic trick.
Yeah, yeah.
This movie doesn't drag, but it's very languid, but it's still moving.
It's like deliberate. It's kind of slow the way, you know, the way you imagine something like freezing over gradually.
Yeah.
But at the same time, yes, it is. It's always moving. It's always changing,
mm-hmm.
and it almost takes you by surprise how far it goes, and just where you find yourself by the end of it.
Right.
You know, compared to where you started out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, because each of these storylines, they're all sort of mirror one another.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's drinking and you know the desire for physical connection. At the key party, at the Manhattan party, and then with ultimately, you know, Sandy and Wendy end up in bed together.
Well, everybody's kind of quote unquote experimenting,
uh-huh.
you know, everybody's like taking this opportunity of being kind of like frozen in together to kind of, you know, break beyond the normal boundaries of what would be acceptable behavior, let's say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's something too that about the weather and the storm that like it's foreboding. And you, even though there's nothing in the movie that really, because it's not like a thriller or anything at all.
Right.
But I remember even the first time I saw it, I felt like someone's going to die.
Yeah.
You just had this foreboding
something has to give,
sense.
Like something, yeah, all this tension that we're feeling has
bad,
to explode
like
in some
really
manner.
Bad is going to happen.
Yeah.
And when you see Mikey the first time, you see this movie and you see him on that frozen diving board.
Yeah.
everyone is thinking like, oh shit, this is it.
I cringe every time that scene comes up when he's jumping.
Oh, he's so slippy.
He almost slips.
Like, what are you doing? You're going to fucking die up there.
Yeah.
Like out in the middle of the woods.
Exactly.
And then when he makes it off, I remember thinking, oh.
He made it.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
little do you know what's coming, of course.
Yeah.
Like the worst thing of all.
Yeah.
But let's talk about the key party.
Yeah.
Like one of the great.
Oh, man.
One of the great sequences in
set pieces.
In movies.
Yeah. Yeah.
So good.
Oh, man.
There's so much going on.
When I watched it last night, I was just appreciating the casting of everybody at that party.
Oh, God,
how
so
everybody
perfect.
Is so memorable and distinctive and has their own little personality that they establish maybe with just a handful of lines or not even.
Yeah, because it's a tense, fraught situation.
Yeah.
From Kevin Kline and how they play that at the beginning with Ben and Elena leaving.
Right.
Going into the car.
Yeah.
And like they're out of there. And he's like, huh, so but maybe we should just stay for a minute. And that's
when
she's like,
yeah.
Fuck this.
Yeah.
Throws her keys to, yep. I mean, Allison Janney.
She aggressively throws the keys. Yeah, it's a great shot, too.
Yeah. And right down to the guy, who's the guy from the Mission Impossible movies?
I know who you're talking about.
The guy that's there, he's a free agent that night. And he's on his own because his wife's out of town.
Oh, yeah.
And he ends up with the overweight lady. And it's just kind of like, hey, let's do it.
Yeah.
It's kind of great.
Yeah.
He's like, all right, that's my number.
Exactly. Oh man, the creepiest guy is the guy who's he points out that the one woman has brought her son,
right?
And then he has that aside line to Kevin Kline where he says, "I wish some of the fathers had brought their daughters."
Yeah,
and he just kind of like slinks away.
Yeah,
and Kevin Kline's just like, "I'm in the wrong place. Something."
Yeah.
I've gone off track. Something
even
is wrong.
Even for 1973, it was like, whoa.
Yeah.
And the guy, the son, he's in plays one of my favorite roles in one of my favorite movies in Flirting with Disaster.
Oh, yeah.
He plays Ronnie.
Okay. It's been
– Or Donnie.
It's been a long time since I've seen that.
He plays Alan Alda and Lily Tomlin's son who laces the quail with
awesome.
With LSD.
I love – oh, man. That's a great movie.
Oh, man. That's one of my all-time favorites. Emily and I –
Richard Jenkins
love that
just
movie. Yeah.
Owns that movie.
You can't catch the wind. It's so good. But yeah, he plays the son who Sigourney Weaver clearly knows his key.
Right.
You kind of get the sense when she pulls that thing out.
It's got that long.
Yeah, it's like the whip that
exactly.
she gives her son to
and she, the way she kind of like twirls her finger around
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
she makes
perfect.
Like a show of the thing. Like she knows exactly what she's doing.
Yeah.
And she just, gathers it in her hand and, and he cuts to the kid and he's just like, all right, rock and roll, let's go, Yeah.
But, what's so interesting, I think, and so true to this film is she sees this younger guy. She isn't satisfied in her marriage. She isn't satisfied with Kevin Kline's affair.
Yeah.
And she goes after this young boy. And what happens at the end of this is she comes home and she gets in the fetal position on that waterbed.
Yeah.
And that shot is just so like, again, another great silent shot that just says so much.
And I always wondered like what happened between the two of them.
I think she had sex that wasn't satisfying.
Just bad
another
empty sex
bad
again,
connection.
And she's kind of come home and she's like, this isn't working. Nothing that I think is going to help is helping.
And you didn't see that coming because throughout this whole film, she is the ice queen.
Yeah.
And she's untouchable and steely and emotionless.
Right.
And what you learn in that one shot is that no, she too is in pain.
She's suffering too. She just has a stronger facade that she's putting forward.
Yeah,
really discourage anybody from trying to get too close in there.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Boy, the way she dumps him at that party is so brutally cold.
Well, it's like, even when she leaves him in the bedroom earlier on and just, drives off in her car.
I had somewhere to be. That's when he confronts her about that.
Yeah, but
the fuck did you go?
It's like I think the reason that she just so quickly detaches from him is because he's starting to, try to establish like more of a relationship. He's telling her about his kind of like quotidian nonsense.
Yeah,
and I think at that point she can't really see him as just like a fun sexual thing. anymore.
It's not that anymore.
He's like a person, and he's kind of boring, and he's kind of reminds her of her husband anyway. Yep,
absolutely.
And so it's just like flipping a switch. It's just like immediately she's done.
Yeah.
And then he has that moment where he's sitting next to her on the bed, and he kind of kisses her neck, and he's trying to, you know, initiate.
Uh-huh.
And she's just like glancing off, completely unmoved, cold, yeah, you know, not feeling anything other than, I wish this guy wasn't here probably.
Yeah.
You know? And this was a dumb idea, and I'm over it, you know?
Yeah.
And then, yeah, the way
– well, and when she dumps him so unceremoniously, yeah, and he's just like, how can you just like be this – he didn't even finish his sentence, yeah, I don't think.
He might say, can't you could just believe, yeah, that cold about her, maybe just so ...
Yeah.
And she just kind of glances out the window and until he goes away.
And then he starts drinking heavily.
Yeah.
And it's that great moment when she does pick the key. It could have been this big thing where he's drunkenly – makes a huge scene about, right, like, wait a minute, you can't bring, yeah, your kid in here.
Yeah.
And like, this isn't how this works.
Yeah.
But what do? He stands up and just goes, no.
Yeah.
And trips over the table.
The glass table, yeah.
And everyone, like, it's just so brutal for Joan Allen.
And especially
because you know
also,
what's going on.
Also, Jim Carver looking on,
yeah,
has this real look of like, he's just put the math together in his head.
Yeah.
Because
he
might not have known before that.
I don't
but he's
think he
just
did.
Like, oh, I see. You
he's
know,
the
not
traveling
only,
husband.
Not
he's
only
gone.
Is my wife going off with this young kid,
uh-huh,
but there's this other grown-up here who I'm,
yeah,
friends with, the family, and
my neighbor.
There's clearly a thing going on between them as well. So he's just kind of, like he says to Joan Allen later, he's like, it's been a pretty thoroughly discouraging evening.
Yeah.
You know? Discouraging or disheartening, something
he
like that.
He's so good.
He really like—
Jamie Sheridan?
Yeah. He's so— The way he really shows up for that third act, you know, like you because throughout the film he's been this kind of like
he's
unknown
a shadow, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He's so so distant, so mm-hmm, removed from everything that there's kind of like a flatness to the character.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when they start to talk to each other and he's like, you know, I'm not that confident that my keys are still in that bowl. It seems like,
yeah,
a bad idea to leave your keys in the bowl like that.
That scene is great, yeah, because that's when she just breaks it down for him.
Yeah.
She says that brutal line. She's like, my husband, you know, I've been married 17 years. He's either passed out or he wishes he was, and I have no intention of going in there and,
right,
getting him.
Right.
And she kind of – I mean, she says like, let's just spend some time together.
Yeah.
And that's when he's like, fuck it.
Yeah.
Like, let's go for a drive,
yeah,
which is in this weather.
Right.
You know,
bad idea.
Not a good idea.
Yeah.
But that car, I didn't call it lovemaking, that car sex scene is just like, it's just one of the most brutally awkward like film encounters you can see.
Yeah. So uncomfortable. So,
oh,
so just.
He apologizes.
Yeah. He's immediately regressing.
He's
like, that was awful. Yeah.
Well, and I think he means himself.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think he's talking about her.
Yeah.
I think he's just. Like this is awful.
Well, he's like, yeah, I mean, it's, sorry. I think he's apologizing in a way. He's,
mm-hmm,
just like, sorry, that was so awful. And I think he still feels like kind of a protectiveness or something towards her.
Yeah.
But he also feels, you know, probably very ashamed of himself in,
uh-huh,
that moment, and just kind of, yeah, it's just unfortunate, the whole thing.
Yeah, but the implication is they're going to go do it right, right?
Yeah, well.
Because she goes in, she says, like, will you wait here for me?
Yeah, yeah.
And she goes in, that great scene in the bathroom.
Oh, man. Tearjerker.
Yeah, like,
yeah,
she kind of strokes his hair.
Yeah.
And it's like, you stay here on the couch.
Yeah. We'll talk in the morning.
Yeah.
You just, you know, get some rest and. Whew. Yeah.
And he's like, I can drive you.
Yeah,
can drive
he wants
you.
To drive, and she's just like, no.
Yeah, even in 1973, she knows, like, you're too drunk to drive.
Yeah.
And I got the picture that, like, she's going to do this right,
mm-hmm,
and go to a house.
Yeah.
To the Carver's,
yeah,
house, I
maybe
guess.
Yeah, maybe so.
Or maybe
so.
Her own house.
Yeah.
And really have sex.
Could be. I had not thought about it that way, but yeah, certainly could. To me, it kind of felt like. They sort of woke up from that,
mm-hmm,
you know, that kind of idealized version they had in their minds of what that might be like.
I mean, maybe they just go have coffee and talk.
That's more where I kind of figure it went to is just that, yeah, they're back to kind of being neighbors and friendly and they just two adults that just want to spend a little time together, kind of pass this crappy night, you know,
right,
until it's the morning.
Make a connection.
Yeah, yeah.
And they have that great low speed car wreck.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I've been in those before where you're going like 4 miles an hour, but you're slipping and you're like, I can't control my car.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
There's nothing I can do right now.
There's a shot in a film that I think probably influenced this film. an Antonioni film called La Notte, mm-hmm. The Night, which is part of his trilogy of kind of, you know, alienation and isolation and so mm-hmm. on. It starts with L'Avventura and ends with L'Eclisse. And La Notte is in the middle of that. In that film, the third act is also like a just basically a party scene mm-hmm. where all these people are gathered together. There's a husband and wife. Their relationship's not going well. Mm-hmm. And the husband is kind of like flirting and pursuing this younger woman. And so he eventually leaves. There's like a big rainstorm that happens. Everybody has to run inside and mm-hmm. the party kind of breaks up. And he gets in the car with this woman that he's kind of pursuing. And they have this long ride in this car as like the rain kind of covers the windows and you can't really see out the windows because mm-hmm. it's raining so hard. Just the way some of those shots are framed are very, very similar to the way yeah. it's shot in this film. I think it's, you know, thematically it makes sense that, yeah. that would be a reference point.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Then we are back with Mikey playing in this storm, and it's so tragic what happens because he is he's so innocent and he's so childlike. He's really being a kid.
He's almost kind of regressed to like that pure childhood.
Yeah, he's out
sense
playing
play.
In the storm.
Yeah.
And he's sliding down the street.
The way he's like jumping through yeah. the snow at that one point.
It was really, really beautiful. And I did not see what, you know, I did have a sense of foreboding the first time I saw it, but
something bad was going to happen. But
I certainly did not see yeah. this
power line.
Yeah, this electrocution.
Yeah.
And even, you know, when it happens and it's, you know,
it feels like he has time to move. You
yeah.
know?
For a second, because yeah. the line is snaking around for a minute.
It's flopping around.
Before it lands on the rail.
It might be like a little bit of slow motion or something.
Maybe.
But it's definitely like there's a moment where he goes like, oh, no. And then
yeah.
boom.
And the way they play that too is just brutal.
Yeah.
Because it's not a big thing. He doesn't even move.
Yeah.
And you're not even sure what happens at first.
Yeah.
And then when he fucking falls
that
over.
That shot of his body sliding down.
Oh, God.
It's
sliding on the
ice.
It's
so brutal. Like,
ugh.
And it's almost, I think, on the commentary, it's sort of like, I don't know, maybe not on the commentary. I think it might have been an interview with Rick Moody where he talked about that scene,
mm-hmm.
Where he was basically saying, like, I didn't even know if they were going to show it to that extent.
Yeah.
That it's so brutal. There's no like quote-unquote restraint in that moment.
Yeah, but it's not graphic.
It's not graphic, but it's definitely looking right at the thing,
yeah.
you know?
Which is a dead kid sliding on the ice.
Yeah, because you probably could have cut the scene right after he falls over or mm-hmm. something, and you would have known that he was dead at that point or at least been fairly certain. But the way
yeah.
that it stays there
I'm
on
glad
the
they
body.
Left it in.
Yeah, I am too.
I mean, it's a gut punch.
But it is like a really, really harsh, you know,
yeah.
moment in the film that is necessary for it to work. But still, it's a little surprising that mm-hmm. that the tone shifts so strongly in that direction.
Well, yeah, because it's already like there's so much turmoil and it's such a sad movie. And then like at the end, they fucking kill this kid.
Yeah.
It's just like – what is going on?
Yeah.
You know?
It's, you know, the thing I've often kind of debated with myself about this movie is whether in some sense you could say it's kind of a fundamentally conservative movie in the way that it's suggesting that all this kind of permissiveness
mm-hmm.
and these kind of like leftover ideas from the 60s you know, extending into the 70s, extending into parents being absent from their kids' lives and, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth, if Mikey is not in some way sort of like the sacrificial lamb or like the he's sort of like paying the price for all this kind of social permissiveness in a way
mm-hmm.
that in the same way that in like Forrest Gump, Jenny
right.
is kind of like
yes.
she receives like all the kind of backlash, let's say,
right.
from the 60s that ultimately
yeah.
she dies.
Well, and Forrest Gump has very famously been, you know, championed as
right.
Very conservative.
And I think the reason that this is not ultimately a conservative film is that it has no illusions about the past
mm-hmm.
being any better,
yeah.
let's say. It's really not saying we went too far in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Let's turn the clock back 20 years to the 50s
right.
and all will be good again.
Right.
It's kind of saying that these people have become disillusioned with that setting,
mm-hmm.
the 50s, you know, the kind of much more, you know, Leave It to Beaver kind
mm-hmm.
of style of life. And and they're looking for something and they haven't found it yet. Mm. And the thing that they have found is kind of a false, like, ideal. It's kind of like it's the wrong answer, mm-hmm. you know, the way they're going about it. But they are trying to find this new thing. They just haven't found it yet.
Yeah.
And their generation kind of doesn't find it necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, I think, a more forward-looking movie mm-hmm. that is, you know, it's just saying that the search for meaning is difficult, you know. But it's certainly not saying we should go back to this, that, or the other thing.
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah, that's an interesting take. I never really thought about that. So, you know, Mikey's gone. And, the last, like, 6 minutes of this movie are just, like, if you thought you were depressed before,
yeah.
it's just, like, heaping it on top of your brain at the end of this when he carries Mikey home and Mr. Carver meets him outside.
Well, first his wife and daughter are the first to see.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like immediately it's the three of them. And then Jim kind of, you know,
first if you think that he like hit him with his car or something.
Right, right.
But because there are no words being spoken.
He says
– he finally says to his dad like –
I found him over on Silver Lane.
Yeah, the power line.
I think it was a power line.
Yeah.
And that's about all he can say.
And it was – the way they shot it was just so brutally real.
Yeah. Well, because now it's morning.
Yeah.
Everything is exposed. It's daylight.
Yeah.
It's sort of like that feeling of
– they've all been up all night.
Yeah, they've all been up all night. And like in the night, things drop off into shadow. It's hard to see – you know, it's hard to get an objective view of the whole situation.
Yeah.
And then in the brutal, harsh reality of like daylight the next morning.
Probably still kind of drunk.
Yeah. Now suddenly everything is made clear and things that, I mean, it's weird. It's like the nighttime, the storm being frozen in, all that kind of affects them psychologically. Mm-hmm. And it drives them into, you know, ways of behaving and, mm-hmm. and crossing certain boundaries that they would never think to do like in just like a warm, normal day, right?
Yeah.
But it's because they've been caught up in this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And now it is like there's like another shot of like the tree line
mm-hmm.
with like the ice kind of like maybe starting to melt a little bit.
Yeah.
And like the sun and the clouds and everything. And it's also very beautiful, but it's at the same time, it's intensely sad.
Yeah.
And it is this kind of realization of like, what have we done? What, you know.
It's almost like the morning after the horror movie night ends.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
it weirdly has the same feeling.
Yeah.
And we should mention too the great part where Joan Allen walks in on Sandy and Wendy in bed.
Yeah, yeah.
And she takes a beat
mm-hmm.
and then she just goes, get dressed.
Yeah.
Like it's not this big show like – Ben would have done and did.
Yeah,
it's just this very quiet get dressed.
Yeah,
and immediately after that is when they show up with Mikey.
Right,
and man, the scene with Mr. Carver when he brings his son in, the son that he is just fairly estranged from even, and then when Sandy walks in, it's just like
brutal, man.
Oh God, it's hard.
Well, there's that moment first where Kevin Kline is almost like giving the body to Jim and. The way he lifts the body up
mm-hmm.
and Kevin Kline almost goes to help him.
Yeah.
And there's this look back and forth between them like, you better not fucking touch my kid.
Yeah.
You know?
He takes him from him.
Yeah, it's like, I don't need your help.
Yeah.
Don't lay a finger on him. There's just like this moment, you know, where they're looking at each other and he kind of like braces him into his chest and brings him inside. And then,
fuck,
I mean, the saddest thing is that he starts taking off the gloves and undoing and he's listening for a pulse, even though it's completely evident to everyone that he's gone. But he still has to do it. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, it's just a very human thing.
Yeah.
And then as soon as he realizes, he just sobbing.
Yeah.
You know? And then
Sandy, Wendy comforts Sandy.
Well, because she takes a step forward to him and he backs off. Like he's kind of scared at first. And then, you know, she just kind of goes in and they really do embrace.
Yeah.
And, you know, the camera kind of like spins around and you see like tears streaming down his face.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because you haven't really seen that kind of overt emotion from him per se.
Yeah, because he's sort of the weird kid.
Yeah.
He's like blowing things up and
exactly.
he shoots the G.I. Joe at her. And you're kind of wondering like, is his kid like on the road to...
Is he like a school shooter or something?
Yeah. I mean, before the, you know, we... That
he,
was even
he has
a thing.
That, he has that moment where he says... you know, I'm gonna put a firecracker on a plane and fly it into Miss So and So's class and blow the whole thing up.
I don't think he is so. I think he's just a little weird
kid. Just a weird kid,
trying to figure it out.
Yeah. But so you even see him kind of getting mm-hmm. broken down by this. Who wouldn't? And then, you know, cutting to Sigourney Weaver upstairs as she wakes up.
Yeah.
And you never even – she never even makes it downstairs as far as what we see.
You don't need to see that.
Yeah.
It works.
But I get a sense from her, even when her eyes open and she's just hearing her husband crying, I think she probably intuits basically what has happened anyway.
Well, that something has happened.
That one of the kids is dead or something really, really bad, you know, has happened.
Yeah, and it's interesting they don't show her seeing that because she has not shown much love to either of her boys in the movie.
Yeah.
And I think it might have read a little false if she came downstairs and broke down sobbing.
It also just been redundant, you know?
Like, yeah, well, that's true for sure. And then, you know, the end, one of my favorite endings and one of my favorite shots in the movie is and certainly Paul knows something is up. Like his whole family doesn't show up to pick him up the morning after he goes into Manhattan.
Yeah, he takes that beat where he's smiling. He's glad to see them. Like, but he's also like, why are you
happened?
Here? Why are you here?
And they have that great shot, man, of the three of them standing there.
Oh, yeah.
And the train station, just solemn.
And the score kind of building. And
yeah.
It always affects me because it's that moment where you realize this family is still intact, you know.
Sort of.
But like, pseudo. But
you get
I mean,
the feeling
they're
can
all
be
alive.
Saved.
Yeah, and yeah, you feel like this might be the moment where
maybe.
They all kind of wake up and things are going to be different from now on. But it's just that sense that
is it hopeful?
It's ambiguous. I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, just that thought that occurs to me every time I see it of just. You know, ultimately, he has his family still.
Mm-hmm.
At least they're around so that they can mend things, so they can fix things.
Mm-hmm.
The Carvers don't have that luxury anymore,
right?
You know, they're,
this thing that I think everyone had taken each other for granted.
Exactly,
it's
that sense that wow, we are actually a family. We're not just these alienated individuals that we can actually still. You know, love each other, help each other, connect with each other.
Yeah.
And maybe if there's like a silver lining in any of this, it is that they have that epiphany where they're like, it's not too late. We can still do something. But
they don't say it. They don't say anything.
Well, like the whole last like, you know, 10, 15 minutes are practically word free.
Yeah. Especially just that car scene like that. It certainly would have changed.
That gets me every time.
Like
Kevin Kline.
Yeah. You could have had dialogue there. You could have had him say what happened.
Yeah.
Like Paul doesn't even say what's going on.
Yeah.
It's just the perfect use of no dialogue.
Kevin Kline starts crying and Joan Allen just says, Jim, like, you know.
Yeah, that's the
only thing she says. And then the rest of it is just bouncing around, you know, everybody looking at everyone else.
Yeah.
You know, he turns back around to his son like he's maybe going to break the news and he can't even do it.
Yeah.
And he turns back around to the steering wheel. He starts crying, you know. Tobey Maguire at this point is got to be like something horrible has happened.
Wendy has tears in her eyes.
We're all here, but nevertheless, something really terrible must have happened. And I love that the last shot of the movie, it ends on Tobey Maguire's face just like not quite grasping yet.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't know. He doesn't know what went down, but it's this uneasy sense of like something really heavy has happened and I don't know yet what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then you kind of realize because he's also the voice of the film.
Yeah.
This is sort of, you know, it's another, whatever you want to call it. It's another like key moment in his life that's going to inform the rest of it. And that has informed the film we've just seen, you know,
his Fantastic Four moment.
He's looked back on, he's looking back on this really important moment in his life. Yeah.
Yeah. And Kevin Kline, I love a thing in a movie where like, He's not crying for Mikey.
No.
You know?
Yeah.
That's part of it probably.
Yeah.
But like he's weeping for his life.
Yeah.
And what he's done.
Yeah. And just that he's taken it so like casually and thoughtlessly, you know? And it's really, at least for the moment, it's shaken him out of that.
Yeah.
But whether, you know, whether things.
What do you think happens? Where's his family in 6 months?
Yeah, it's really tough to say.
In the summertime.
They could kind of just like go back, you know, fall back asleep. I mean,
that's what I think happens.
Paul's got a couple more years left of high school, but he's already away.
Mm-hmm.
Wendy's going to be gone in, you know, similar time frame if she's going to like a boarding school type thing as well.
Yeah.
So, and then, you know, maybe, especially once the kids are out of the house, maybe they do get divorced or something, you know?
Yeah.
So maybe this is like, you know, one last hurrah of like, hey, we're a family, but ultimately, you know, it's too late. It's, I don't know.
Yeah.
I do probably lean in that direction as well, rather than
not helpful.
Everybody lived happily ever after and kind of like
nothing really says that they're gonna turn it all around.
No.
Man, what a great movie. New Canaan, Connecticut.
Yeah, yeah. That the setting it in New Canaan also interesting to me. That is where Rick Moody grew up.
Yeah, I knew that.
And the fact that they were shooting the movie in that town, and people from that town, of course, had read the book and were not happy with the book because it doesn't exactly reflect positively on.
It didn't really show New Canaan. It shows a couple of houses in the woods.
No, but just like the kind of people who live there, let's say, or the kind of lives they lead, they felt maybe like a little bit, you know, like slandered by that.
Yeah.
And so, but the New Canaan, Canaan being like a biblical idea. Yeah. In the Bible, there's like the whole story about the false idol, the Canaanites, and you know, Moses going up on the mountain, coming down with the tablet and everything.
Yeah.
I always wondered. I mean, I guess it's not a conscious choice because that is literally where he's from.
Right.
But it did kind of make me wonder at a certain point: is he saying that everybody in this town is kind of worshiping a certain false idol? Like they're
Look at you.
They're kind of
got your film thesis paper already.
Yeah, yeah. they're sort of they're receiving these secondhand ideas from the 60s that have like filtered out finally into the suburbs, you know?
Yeah.
And so they're all kind of playing catch up with what was happening in more like urban centers, let's say, you know, 5 or 10 years earlier.
Yeah.
But the whole idea of like free love and kind of these kind of freewheeling sexual, you know, things. And it's just interesting. I don't know if that's
yeah.
what the film is driving at, but certainly the idea of like the ice storm itself being like kind of like this act of nature, act of God, whatever you want to call it.
Uh-huh.
There's a sense again in these films we were mentioning at the beginning, like Shortcuts, like Magnolia, that there is this kind of omniscient thing that is looking on and that is in a way punishing these characters, but at the same time is also trying to wake them up out of their slumber, you know, and unite people again.
Yeah. Boy. This is one of my favorite movies, Casey.
Same. Absolutely.
Glad we got to talk about it.
Yeah. So one last thing, just, you know, more thematic stuff that's kind of buried in the film.
Mm-hmm.
When Sigourney Weaver is in bed earlier on, she's on the waterbed, she's reading, her husband's come home.
Mm-hmm.
She's reading a book by Philip Roth.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you look on their bookshelf by the bed, there's also like John Updike.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, the family being named the Carvers, this film is kind of, it belongs to like that tradition of 60s disillusionment with, say, the American dream.
Yeah.
You know, the picket fence and the two kids and the
like
dog and all
what's
that.
What's going on behind that picket fence?
Yeah, yeah. And so it's tapping into that. And it's interesting that it so deliberately references that in the context of the film.
Right.
But
it's sort of tucked away at least.
Yeah, it's tucked away. But it's just – it's in a way I also think about like, you know, a couple years later, like American Beauty, for instance.
Yeah.
That similar kind of feeling
for
of, again, suburban disenchantment and, you know, set in a contemporary, you know, setting. But very much the same idea. You know, that there's beauty in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could say the same for the ice storm, that it's very beautiful, but at the same time, it's also, there's a sadness there.
Yeah.
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 We'll finish on this. So, do you like Radiohead?
Sure. Love Radiohead.
Do you like the album In Rainbows?
I love In Rainbows. I love them all.
Do you like the song House of Cards?
I love them all.
So, all right, the lyrics to House of Cards are more or less inspired by this film.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the most direct gesture towards it. The infrastructure will collapse from voltage spikes. Throw your keys in the bowl. Kiss your husband goodnight.
Oh.
Forget about your house of cards and I'll do mine. Forget about your house of cards and I'll do mine. Fall off the table.
Mm-hmm.
Get swept under. Denial, denial. There you go.
All right. Do you think that's what they were thinking?
Oh, yeah. Because the even the idea of the key party,
mm-hmm.
I kind of assumed it was a thing that really happened in the 70s.
It is.
But it's I feel like our cultural awareness of it is almost like it's more due to this film. Maybe I'm wrong, but I had the understanding anyway that it's almost like a, you know, it's the kind of thing people talked about going on.
Mm-hmm.
There may not be so many like firsthand accounts of it, but
sure.
I think certainly Radiohead here is thinking like explicitly of this film when they say fall off the table, get swept under.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Benjamin Hood standing up, mm-hmm. banging his knee on the table. Throw your keys in the bowl, kiss your husband goodnight.
Yeah.
You know, the infrastructure will collapse, the voltage spike, all that stuff.
Yeah.
I think is pretty consciously evoking this film.
Yeah. I'll have to do a little digging on that.
Yeah.
All right, man. Well, that was great. And we'll figure out what we're going to do next time.
Yeah. This has been kind of two pseudo mainstream movies in a row.
Sure.
If you want to call it that. So for the next one, we'll try to find something really far out.
All right. That sounds good.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Movie Crush is produced, edited, and engineered by Ramsey Yunt here in our home studio at Pont City Market, Atlanta, Georgia, for iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.